Okay, welcome everybody. This is the sixth and final lecture for the class, Mises Academy class, Anarcho-Capitalism. Today's date is September 5th, 2012. And the topic for today is how do we get there? So this is a brand new lecture for this course, because as you may remember, the first time we offered this, it was only a four-week course, just dealing basically with private law and private defense and objections and historical applications. This time around, the course, adding 2 weeks to it, what we did is we expanded the private law part because I realized there was just so much more material to cover there with appeals and stuff like that. So that was where one of the extra weeks came in, and then now this final lecture is where the other increment came in. All right, so this is all new material as far as me giving this course. And what we're basically doing, as the name suggests or the title suggests, the idea is, look, let's suppose I've convinced you, or you already knew coming into this, and that's why you signed up for the course, to just get preached at by the religion you already believe in. Suppose we agree that, yes, we now believe that a free society, meaning one in which the vast majority of people obey property rights or respect property rights, and there's not this systematic violator of property rights, what we now refer to as the state, because that's one of the hallmarks of the state, that it is an institution basically of organized coercion, however else you want to talk about it. From a Rothbardian point of view, that's what a state is. Well, that's one way to describe it accurately, and so it's weird to think the way we're going to defend property rights is to enshrine this institution that by its very nature systematically violates property rights, that we're going to contain theft by having a group of people who can steal from us at will, almost, and that we're going to contain violence by having some group be exempt from the normal prohibitions on blowing people up and throwing them in cages and so forth. All right, so let's suppose I've convinced you not only that, yeah, that would be great if we could somehow be in such a world that a lot of people would say, yeah, if that were possible, that would be great. But then a lot of people say, well, it's not possible. And so maybe in light of the stuff we've read this course and the arguments I've given you and the discussion you've had with each other in the forums, maybe now you're convinced that not only is that an ethically better system, but actually it would work if we could somehow have a society of 20 million people that lived in this fashion. Not only would they be safer from domestic run-of-the-mill criminals compared to the present system, but actually they wouldn't get invaded by a foreign army. And so that, you know, if we could ever have that starting point of a Rothbardian-type society starting at time zero, if I'm going to peek at it at time 100, I wouldn't expect it to be full of radiation poisoning from an atom bomb or nuclear bomb, and I also wouldn't expect to see a state that had arisen from the ashes, because people just need to have states or something. It's part of human nature. I don't agree with any of that. I think it'd be stable. Okay. But yet, there's a third problem, or a third issue, is, so again, the three things. First of all, do you think such a thing is ethically better? You know, in terms of your value system, would you prefer to live in that kind of a world? Second thing is, even if you do think that in some moral or ethical sense it's better, is it practical? You know, could such a world exist? Because there's lots of people who agree with the vision of Rothbard. They like where he's going with it. They just think he's naive. That we'd get conquered, or no, somebody would just form a new government. All right, so it's not that they like taxes or that they like the monopoly police force. It's just they say, well, it's better than living under the tyranny that we would live under when some rival state conquered us. Okay, but now the third thing is, okay, suppose I've sold you that it's ethically better and that it would work if we ever got there. Now the question is, how do we get there? Given that we have the world as it is right now, and I've convinced some people, relying on standing on the shoulders of the previous giants, that, yep, an anarcho-capitalist society would be better than this one and would also work, what do we do? And there's all kinds of different things. Some people would say, oh, we got to go vote for Libertarian Party. Other people would say, no, that's stupid. Libertarians won't win. Let's go get to fiscal conservative Republicans and keep their feet to the fire. Let's get rid of all these rhinos, Republicans in name only, right? Other people, and other people say, no, that's, don't look at the political process. That's crazy. It's a waste of time. We need to just teach people to get off the grid, you know, start growing your own vegetables and stuff and do all your transactions with encryption and blah, blah, blah. Other people say, that's crazy. When you're living in the border of the United States, it's not going to work. We need to get Texas to secede. Other people say, that's crazy. We tried secession. Look what happened. We need to go start our own country somewhere. Okay, so the point is, there's all kinds of different things people say. Other people say, you're wrong to look at the external world. Just free your mind, man. Just have anarchy in your head, right? You don't let anyone else put constraints on you, man. Some people talk like that, okay? So the point is, and maybe it came off like you thought that you knew which strategy I personally endorsed, and I was making fun of the other ones. I was actually trying to make fun of all of them. But the point is, these are the questions of strategy that people have. And that was one of the things that Rothbard, either love him or hate him, he was huge on strategy, and he would write all sorts of stuff on that. And so, like I said, the people who loved him thought, this is great. Not only was Rothbard a brilliant theorist, but he also was a practical guy, could roll his sleeves up and get into the rough and tumble. He would go to political conventions. He would write analyses of, you know, George Bush versus whoever he was running it, and talking about H.W. Bush versus, you know, his opponent and so forth. Well, it was Clinton in the second one. I can't remember who H.W. Bush went against in the when he first ran, when he won. Right, so there's stuff like that. And then in Rothbard, I mean, some people, it creeps him out. At times when Rothbard's writing, he explicitly, I'm not putting words in his mouth, he acknowledges that he's emulating what the Marxists would do in terms of, you know, Rothbard thought that the problem with free market libertarians was they were all about theory and just devoted very little attention to the actual strategy, like how do we change the world to conform to our views, whereas he said the Marxists were the other way around, that their theory was awful and they should have spent more time getting their theory straight, and instead they spent the bulk of their time just figuring out how are we going to get our ideas implemented. And so Rothbard was saying, we need to, yes, theory is important, and Rothbard lives it. Obviously, there was no greater libertarian theorist than Rothbard, but he also spent a lot of time talking about party politics and, you know, making compromise and reaching out to these certain groups. I mean, Rothbard famously would reach out to people who disagreed with him strongly on many issues. But he thought, maybe I can get more liberty, advance the cause of liberty in the United States at least, by building coalitions. And he would try with like anti-war leftists, maybe in the 60s or early 70s, and then that didn't work, and then he would switch to sort of right-wing cultural traditionalists and try it that way and so on and so forth. And, of course, in his mind, the overriding strategy was, I am trying to get as much liberty as possible. And then even there, though, he would have memos about being careful, like you don't want to compromise your core principles, you don't want to become such a big tent that, you know, your movement's lost. And all right, so Rothbard did it all, and tonight, I'll try to be clear tonight when I'm talking about my own personal things and when I'm just summarizing somebody else's perspective. Because a lot of my own views are going to be seeping in here, so I'll at least try to flag it so you guys know when I'm just being the professor and when I'm talking to you as a fellow anarcho-capitalist. Okay. I see someone mentioning Stefan Molyneux. I don't have him in this lecture, but actually he is one of the leading intellectuals, strategists, whatever you want to call them, right now in the libertarian movement on these types of issues. And it's the reason I don't have him in here is just because I assigned the readings before and I was trying to pick more canonical, old school, classic references. But in terms of today in the rough and tumble, who is one major icon that has a very well-defined and extreme position would be him. And I'm saying extreme not to say it's wrong, but just saying there's no one who's more Stefan than Stefan. Put it that way. That's what I'm trying to get at there. Just like somebody one time said, some comedian was like, you know, nobody ever says, yeah, that guy's like Liberace, but more so. Okay, just, that wouldn't make sense. Okay, so let's get going. So, incidentally, I may mispronounce this guy's name. Roderick Long knows how to pronounce it well. If I were at Mises U giving this lecture to you guys, I would grab him before going up and saying it and make sure I'm pronouncing it right. And what's really bad is I took many years of French, so you would think I would know how to say it. So I'm going to pronounce it Etienne de la Boite, but that's perhaps not how you say it. Okay. I understand that a lot of you guys don't have time to do the readings. So what I'm going to do here, even though I feel funny, like I'm dealing with bunch of sixth graders or something, let me read some of the stuff because I don't want you to miss it. And I'm really kind of giving you a commercial saying, if you just read one thing from this week's material, read what I assigned, what it is. It's not an excerpt from him. It's Murray Rothbard's introduction to the book, The Politics of Obedience, The Discourse of Voluntary Servitude. All right, so is this, if you're looking at the PowerPoint right now, you can see here what's the significance of this illustration that the Institute slapped on the cover. It shows people jumping off cliffs. So what are they trying to get at there? The big picture of this and the title of the discourse of voluntary servitude, what do they mean by that term voluntary? And yet servitude means what they is putting his finger on. He's one of the earliest people to do it with such clarity and vision, is he's diagnosing the fact that this is odd. We have this situation where there's a few people ruling everybody, or maybe even just one guy who is clearly at the top of this hierarchy or pyramid. And on the one hand, you want to say, oh, it's because of all the guns or way back because of swords or whatever. It's got all the cavalry. And Labuete is saying, but no, that's not really a good explanation. And I'm going to read you some of his quotes later to hear it in his own words. But the point is it's voluntary. So it is servitude. And it's an interesting dichotomy or juxtaposition, I suppose is a better word. This voluntary servitude and Rothbard clearly likes everything in this train of thought. I mean, Rothbard writes a very glowing introduction here. And so like I say, on the one hand, let's be clear that we are talking about servitude here. There is coercion involved. It's not that this is all a voluntary arrangement in the sense that it's all free market stuff. I mean, there is a state entity going on here. There is coercion in the libertarian sense of the term, and yet he's modifying it with this adjective of voluntary. So on the one hand, superficially, you can say, well, that's a contradiction. If it's servitude, then it's not voluntary, and if it is voluntary, the servitude is, you know, if it just means like I'm literally a servant, like some rich guy hires me to bring him dinner and stuff, and so I'm his servant, well, I've got a problem with that as a libertarian, and that's not what we mean when we use servitude in this context, right? So there is this superficial tension, but you'll see the sense in which Labuete means this, and it's important if he's right. All right, so like I said, with that introduction, let me just read you some things. So again, I'm reading from what I assigned you guys for week six, and this is Rothbard introducing this discourse. And so here is, so now this is a quote, so this is Rothbard quoting, so these are de la Boite's words that I'm reading right now. I should like merely to understand how it happens that so many men, so many villages, so many cities, so many nations, sometimes suffer under a single tyrant who has no other power than the power they give him, who is able to harm them only to the extent to which they have the willingness to bear with him, who could do them absolutely no injury unless they preferred to put up with him rather than contradict him. Surely a striking situation. Yet it is so common that one must grieve the more and wonder the less at the spectacle of a million men serving in wretchedness, their necks under the yoke, not constrained by a greater multitude than they. Okay, so, like in the United States, for example, with the population, give or take 300 million, how many people are in the federal government? And then really, and you don't just mean like some civil servant, like some guy answering the phone in the Department of the Treasury. I mean, how many actual people would you say run the U.S. government? Like, they are the ruling class. We could quibble about how broadly to include that group, and also there'd be people that many of you would include in this group that aren't officially employees of the U.S. government. Like many of you probably think like Rupert Murdoch or George Soros or guys like that, who are these incredibly rich and powerful, influential private people that yet clearly behind the scenes have a lot to do with what governments end up doing. You might include them. Okay, fine. But the point is, how many people on planet Earth even would you say are in the ruling class? And again, we could quibble about the numbers, but I doubt you're going to put in more than a million compared to what, a population of 6 billion on Earth? So it's a weird situation where you've got a million or even less, if you want to be tighter with your criterion, people ruling over billions. And so that's what the Labwete wants to explore, because it's odd. And so one natural explanation is to just say, well, it's not consensual, that they're afraid. The people, the ruled, the people being ruled, are only obeying out of fear that the people in charge can punish them, hurt them. So that's why they do it. And so to that, De Labuete says, shall we call subjection to such a leader cowardice if 100, if 1,000 endure the caprice of a single man? Should we not rather say that they lack not the courage but the desire to rise against him, and that such an attitude indicates indifference rather than cowardice? When not 100, not 1,000 men, but 100 provinces, 1,000 cities, 1,000,000 men refuse to assail a single man from whom the kindest treatment received is the infliction of serfdom and slavery, what shall we call that? Is it cowardice? When 1,000, 1,000,000 men, 1,000 cities fail to protect themselves against the domination of one man, this cannot be called cowardly, for cowardice does not sink to such a depth. What monstrous vice, then, is this which does not even deserve to be called cowardice, a vice for which no term can be found vile enough? All right, so what do you mean? I'm going to circle back here and try to get a little bit more nuanced. In this passage, he's looking at just the king or the guy on top. He's saying there's a sense, if we're looking at the monarchy, the king is the ruler and everybody else is subject to his authority. And so it's not, to use a more modern metaphor or analogy, it's not like he's General Zod from Superman 2, the movie, the guy from Krypton that also has Superman's powers, and he and his two accomplices come to Earth, and Superman is out of commission because he's off courting Lois Lane and foolishly gives away his powers. And then just nobody can stand up to these guys. They can just kill anybody, right? And so they just go around, and then they get the whole world to transfer all authority to General Zod. Interesting. Let me just go off on a little tangent, a little Superman 2 tangent. That very thing actually underscores one of the main points of this course. The way General Zod and Superman, I hope most of you have seen Superman 2, otherwise this is going to be goofy, but the way he takes over Earth so quickly is because there's all these governments already established. If planet Earth had been an anarcho-capitalist planet, and these three guys from Krypton who all have Superman's powers, and Superman's not able to stop them in the beginning of the movie because he's off in love. Under anarcho-capitalism, yeah, nobody could stop him. It's not like entrepreneurs would just say, oh, well, it's profitable if we can come up with a way to kill these guys, so let's do it. I mean, unless somebody, I guess probably the market would start mass-producing kryptonite, but you get the point that, okay, they're physically unstoppable. The human beings with their technology can't stop the guys from Krypton. So if the guys from Krypton are bent on domination, they can go around setting up governments if they want. But the point is, if they encountered an anarcho-capitalist planet Earth, it would probably take them a decade to get the thing all set up, because they'd have to go from region to region and first you just grab somebody. You know, they could just show up in a town and say, okay, we're setting up a system of tribute and a system of legal authority, and I'm at the top, General Zod, and if we catch anybody stepping on a line, we'll just kill you with our heat vision or something, and there's nothing you guys can do to stop us. And every time there's an uprising, we'll just fly in there and just start killing people until you all get back in the line, and there's nothing you can do because we're from Krypton. They could do that, and they could impose a state all over the world, but the point is it would take them a long time, whereas in the movie, they do it in like 3 days after they show up, the whole world has surrendered, because all they need to do is get the major government leaders from around the world to cede their authority to General Zod. So it's pretty easy to get 6 billion people under your rule if you've already got a bunch of governments all around the world. You just got to convince the heads of those governments, you don't want to mess with me because I'll just kill you. So if you want to stay in position of your power, you tell everyone you serve me. And I'll let you still remain at the seat of your government. So you're still the president of the United States, it's just now you report to me, General Zod. And that's boom. He just instantly took over the whole United States because there was already that machinery in place. Okay, but back to De La Muerte. The point is, that's not the situation. The kings, when he was writing, didn't have superhuman powers. So why is it that a nation of millions would say, oh, this guy, this one guy, this human being, this king, is above all of us in terms of political authority? De La Muerte is saying it's not because we're physically afraid of him, because what can he do? He's one guy. So it's not that. It's something else. Okay. And then one thing I wanted to read, where is it? So if you... I had highlighted something, but then I rebooted in order to make sure my internet was good. Let me see here. Hang on a second. Okay, so then the last thing is, if when you see where he's coming from, De La Muerte, if you get the big picture and you see, okay, yeah, there is a sense, an important sense, in which rulers are not there, don't have their position of power because they seized it from us, and we don't remain in this state of subjugation and tyranny because they're such awful people and they just punish dissenters and they keep us all in line because we're all afraid. When you realize, no, there's an important sense in which the power they have over us, we give it to them, then how do we solve the problem of tyranny? Well, you don't need a revolution. You don't need to go shoot the guy. You don't need to hang them. So this is De La Muerte. Obviously, there is no need of fighting to overcome this single tyrant, for he is automatically defeated if the country refuses consent to its own enslavement. If the tyrants, quote, are simply not obeyed, they become undone and as nothing. And then this is De La Muerte talking. Resolve to serve no more, and you are at once freed. I do not ask that you place hands upon the tyrant to topple him, but simply that you support him no longer. Then you will behold him like a great colossus whose pedestal has been pulled away, fall of his own weight and break in pieces. All right, so that's some pretty awesome stuff. Right, that the tyrant will topple if we all refuse our consent. Okay, so you understand what he's talking about, right? That so he's looking at it holistically, or in the aggregate, if you will. And it certainly is true that absent a Superman 2 scenario and Kryptonian, any human being who is a political authority figure, if all the population except that guy just decided tomorrow we're going to ignore him, there's nothing he could do. He's no longer in charge. All right? So don't worry. For those of you who are getting uncomfortable and think this is simplistic and is stupid, I'm going to acknowledge the problems with this approach, but I wanted you to at least see it in its pure form. All right? For example, and I may circle back and repeat myself a few times in this lecture, but let me say it now to make sure I don't forget. A lot of libertarians, when they're picturing how are we going to get to what we consider to be a free society, a lot of them think that stuff like, oh, we'll elect somebody like Ron Paul, and then he'll start slashing stuff, and then we'll elect somebody else who's even more radical, and he'll start abolishing positions, and eventually we'll elect some president who will then, in his final act, abolish the presidency itself. And that's the way we'll get rid of the state, is that we have to keep educating people, the voters, and keep electing more and more hardcore people who eventually, in the final act, dissolve the government itself, and that's the way we unwind it. Other people say, no, that's stupid. We don't need to do that. We're playing by the government's own rules. It's a corrupt system. They picture it as we'll get enough people so that lots of people start defecting from the army and the other armed forces, and because they realize they don't want to fight us, and then we storm Washington with guns, and then hopefully the government just surrenders, and that's it, and we have like a people's convention and go back to whatever. Or if they do fight back, well, tough for them. And then we win the Civil War, but we don't put a new government in place once we topple the existing government because we're anarchists. Right? And that's the way other people think about it. The way I think about it, the thing that I think would be awesome, is you convince everyone or enough people to be anarchists, and so the President of the United States walks in and like everyone just nobody shows up for work. I'm like, what the heck? And he walks out and he sees people on the street and he says, hey, what are you doing? Come, I'm the president. Where's everybody? And they're just like, oh, well, I don't believe in that. And he's just walking around, and he's just dumbfounded. And it's not that anyone shoots at him. It's not that he had to sign a piece of paper saying, okay, I abolished the presidency. It's just everybody just says, no, we don't believe in that anymore. And they just go about their own life, and that's it. And the government just gone. It doesn't affect anybody's behavior. And the few people who still believe in it go around trying to say, oh, I'm the president, or I'm the mayor, you owe me taxes. And I was like, oh, that's funny. And they just ignore him. And he can't do anything because he goes up to police officers or whatever and says, hey, arrest those people, they're not paying their taxes. And they say, I actually don't consider myself an employee anymore. I work for a private security firm, and that private judge over there said that this guy is legal. He doesn't owe anybody any money. He didn't have a contract with you. He doesn't owe you money. What are you talking about? Right? So that's, to me, would be the best thing of all. And that you'll see that at the end when I talk about what can we do to promote liberty. All right? So anyway, but let me also be clear. A lot of what I'm saying tonight is just my own personal value system and my own understanding of how do you influence people. And that's a lot of what we're going to talk about in the subsequent slides. So I'm not saying standard libertarian theory means this is the way we would have to get to a stateless society, otherwise we initiated aggression. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying me personally, when I want to have a daydream about what would it look like if we finally got to where we were going, I would love it if that's the way it happened, whereas I think other people have different visions. Okay. Let me now throw some water on De La Buete here. One last thing before I criticize it. This is consistent with David Hume's point when he argues that all government rests on the consent of the governed. All right. I'm putting quotation marks around this. I'm not saying that's an exact quote from David Hume, but I'm saying that's a point he made in Mises himself when he's talking about this stuff. I don't recall Mises citing Bale of Wethe. I recall him citing Hume, or at least I know for sure Mises cites Hume. So this is not just some obscure thing that Rothbard picked up from somebody. Mises was also in line with this. And what's funny is Mises used it to justify democracy. He endorsed what is sometimes called the ballots versus bullets. Justification for democracy. Right, so Mises didn't use the phrase ballots versus bullets, but that's what other political theorists have dubbed this. So what Mises says is that, like, if in the book Liberalism, for example, where Mises is talking about classical liberalism, the reason Mises favors democracy as a political form of government as opposed to monarchy or aristocracy or tyranny, obviously, is that he says, ultimately, as David Hume pointed out, all governments are popular, meaning in the broad scheme of things, there cannot be an unpopular government. There can't be a regime in power that does not at least tacitly have the consent of the public, because if it didn't, if it really were the case that the public did not like the regime that was in power, they would just overthrow it. And again, the point is the regime is always this small percentage of the population, and so that's how they have to stay in power, is to keep the public happy. Now, there's all kinds of caveats you could use and qualifiers and so forth and say, well, really, it's not that the public likes the regime, it's that the public doesn't dislike them enough to make it worthwhile to risk getting killed if you wanted to rise up against them, that kind of thing. And the other thing is, So Mises is saying the reason he favors democracy is not because he believes in the will of the people or the wisdom of the people. Far from it. Mises thinks the people can be idiots, and he knows they don't know basic economics, and that's why tariffs are popular and inflation and all kinds of other minimum wage laws, rent control laws, and so forth. How would Mises explain them? I mean, it's because the people are stupid or ignorant of economic law, and so they support government policies that are popular but are detrimental. But Mises still is a Democrat with a small d in the interest of peace, because he says, ultimately, if the public thinks tariffs are good, the government is going to have tariffs. That whether you have a monarchy or an aristocracy or democracy, the reason we want to have a democracy is that the public, if it doesn't like what's going on in the regime, it just waits and replaces it at the next election. Whereas if you have some other form of government, then the only way to get rid of it is to have a violent revolution. Or if it's a monarchy and you don't like the king, you can kill the king and then have his successor be the new king. But with a democratically elected government, Mises says, all you got to do is wait till the next election and then vote in some other regime. So that's, for him, the primary reason to be a Democrat with a small d, is that it prevents the need for civil wars. All right, so that's, like, again, often called the ballots versus bullets defense of democracy, and I hope that phrase makes sense to you, saying you replace the regime by casting a ballot rather than shooting a bullet. Okay, so notice that too relies on this notion, and as I say, Mises cited Hume, but it's also consistent with what Bale of Wethe is saying, of there is an important sense in which all governments are popular. All right, now having said all that, let me advance the slide here. Let's talk a little bit about totalitarian states, because there is there's an obvious sense in which what De La Guette is saying is wrong or is incomplete. And so I want to just step back and acknowledge that so you don't think that we're just being completely naive here, but then say even with this nuanced understanding, it still is true that De La Guette has a lot of important insight. All right, so in an extreme case, we can imagine a dictator whom everyone despises and wishes were dead. All right, so I'm going for the extreme case here. So we can imagine the situation. Now, how do we get here? Well, we can talk about that. But let's imagine the situation where there's one guy, and he's the dictator, and every single person in the whole country hates this guy's guts. Even the people in his secret police, even his chief of security, whose job it is to make sure nobody tries to assassinate this guy. Everybody in his inner circle, let alone the general peasant out starving to death because of this guy's policies, everybody hates this guy's guts. They know this is an awful ruler. They pray every night if they're religious that this guy will have a heart attack. They can't wait till he's dead. And so you wonder, well, how can this system maintain itself then? And the answer is that he somehow orchestrated it so that if anyone challenges him, others kill that person. And if anyone fails to kill an assassin, others kill that guy. Or others kill him too. So that's the way you could imagine the system working. And so notice this is analogous to what we were talking about before about like these intricate boycotting hierarchies where you can imagine a system, if you could ever get to it, it would be self-sustaining where somebody, if a private judge says, oh, this guy's a criminal, he's living on a shack on the hill, and so the power company says, okay, we're not going to sell him electricity, and the package delivery company says, okay, we're not going to deliver steaks to his outside his house in exchange for him electronically sending us money, even though that would be in our narrow self-interest. We have these interlocking agreements where we all agree we're going to boycott this guy, and why do we do it? Not just out of altruism or not out of our sense of duty, but because we've got these complex, elaborate arrangements where if we're caught trading with a known criminal, then we ourselves get boycotted. And so that keeps us in line and helps us enforce the boycott. And then why would other people do that to me? Because they in turn, da 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 da. Okay, so you can imagine something like that with the dictator, and this of course is what happens in real life, where the totalitarian dictator, and maybe people are, I mean, people around Hitler knew he was going nuts, or a lot of them did, and there's obviously movies about this with Tom Cruise and so on. But the point is, once he gets to that level of power and he's that ruthless and you've seen him kill people, even the people who follow his order to go kill people might only be doing it because they know if they refuse his order and he still hangs on to his power for another 24 hours, then they're dead too. All right, so you can, again, this extreme case, you can imagine that that's true of every single person. There's not a single person in the whole country who ideologically supports this dictator, but yet, if they accurately expect that if they disobey an order from him and then he turns to the other people standing around with guns and say, well, it's treason, kill him, and then they'll obey him, well, then that's how you keep everybody in line. So it's a mutually reinforcing thing. Okay, so you can imagine that. So in this framework, then, you could argue De La Guette's arguments are a little bit odd, that really he's not arguing in terms of methodological individualism, he's arguing from a macro perspective. What De La Guette really has shown is if we could all agree in one fell swoop that we're going to ignore the dictator, then he has no power over us. But once you start getting into like game theory, if you will, and looking at individual incentives and so on, it's hard for an individual to step outside of that framework if everybody else is still in it and if we're not coordinated, right? So a classic thing would be, you know, even now, if we all just stopped paying taxes, the U.S. government would crumble, U.S. federal government. They couldn't, you say, well, they would just lock you up. Well, not if they had no tax revenue. If every single person in the United States would put zero down for his income next April 15th, and they stopped, you know, an employer stopped withholding and just reported, nope, our employees are making zero, sorry. Obviously, the people of the IRS would know they're being lied to, and they could start arresting people like crazy, but with no incoming tax revenue, they're going to run out of money pretty quickly. And you could say, oh, they could borrow it. Right. And then what's going to happen to interest rates on government securities when investors around the world see that there's a tax revolt going on and they have $0 coming into the Treasury month after month? They might lend money initially, just assuming it's a minor little thing, the U.S. government put it down, but if it just persists, and even though 500,000 people get rounded up and sent off to prison with 20-year sentences, and still the people who are still out working every month keep telling their employer, no, I don't want to don't withhold any money, and the employer says, okay. And this, the U.S. government keeps getting 0, 0, 0 every month in terms of tax receipts. Eventually, the interest rate on their debt's going to skyrocket, and you know they could turn to the Fed, but even that, eventually, what's going to happen to the value of the dollar when everyone realizes there is no way the government is ever going to get revenue except by printing it, then the dollar would crash, and they would eventually, the U.S. government would have no means of financing itself. All of its employees, if you say, oh, that's got all these employees that would lock people up, they're not, how are they getting paid, right? I mean, they could be getting pieces of paper that say, we promise we're going to pay you once we resolve this, but you can't take that to the grocery store. And so the point is, they would, all the enforcement agents who work for the IRS and everybody, they would all have to start eventually quitting because they're not getting paid. And so I'm saying that if you could systematically enforce a boycott of the federal government, you wouldn't need a revolution. If everyone in the whole country just stopped paying taxes, then what could they do? Because then even the people who got locked up for 20-year sentences eventually would probably get let out when the whole regime collapsed, right? So that's the thing. And you wouldn't even need to get killed, right? If it was just purely, you know, we weren't resisting in any way. We were just saying, we're not paying you any money. And so when guys show up at your doorstep and they send the SWAT team and stuff, you don't do something stupid like shoot at them. You don't have chemical bombs that you're making in your basement or something. You're totally, you're like Ned Flanders in terms of your demeanor and the way you talk to the government officials, except the one thing is you don't pay them. And if you don't even want to lie, you could say, okay, yeah, technically I owe you this money according to the tax laws, but you know what, I'm not giving it to you. So yeah, they could come in, freeze your assets and so on, but the point is if everybody did as much as they possibly could to limit how much money the government could take from them, the U.S. government would grind to a halt pretty quickly. It would collapse, and then everybody would be free. Okay, so why is that? Why doesn't that happen? Well, there's two things. One is not every American wants that. The scenario I just described would scare the heck out of 90% of Americans, at least. And so that's one major reason, because they would disagree. They'd say, that's a horrible outcome. We'd have anarchy, and then the Mexican government would come in and take us over or something, or the Chinese would see our weakness and come take us over. So that's one thing. But then the other thing is, even if everybody were a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist, it would be hard to coordinate that strategy, because if just 10,000 of us say, okay, we're not paying taxes, go team, and then they look over behind their shoulder and the rest of them are like, well, I got a wife and kids and I'm doing really good in my career right now and I don't want to go to jail for 6 months. And so you guys try it. Let's see what happens. And then we'll see how it goes. Well, that won't work, because then the government will send in the SWAT teams where those 10,000 people will get locked away for 20 years and everyone else will say, I'm not doing that and go to jail for 20 years. Right? And they'll keep paying their taxes and the government can afford to keep those guys in prison and hire more IRS analysts and crack down on everybody and say, don't you dare do that again or you're going to jail for 20 years like these people did. All right, so that's kind of the dichotomy there. Okay, now, I see someone in the comments saying, and perhaps it's a joke, but I do want to emphasize it. Someone says, Ned Flanders would get shot instantly by the feds. And again, I don't know if whoever said it is just making a joke. But let's think this through. It would look very bad for the government, right? And that's what I'm stressing, and then I'll say this later on probably too. If you're going to try something like that, and this dovetails with what Gandhi did and Martin Luther King and so on, it hurts your cause if you introduce violence, right? If what you're trying to do is something like that, like if you realize reading De La Bhatti, wait a minute, if we just all stop paying our taxes, what are they going to do to us? Well, the way you convince others to join your cause and to convince them that we're in the right here is you just sit there and take it. So when the feds pull up, you know, if you're armed and you say, you come on my property, I'm shooting you, and then there's a little shootout and they send in the, you know, gas that's been banned in international warfare and kill you, then everyone says, well, he had it coming. He was shooting at the Fed. What do you expect? But if you're like Ned Flanders and they really did come in and gun you down, and especially if somebody catches it on their iPhone and puts it on YouTube, that looks really bad because the government, they can say to people, oh, if you don't pay your taxes, we're going to put you in a cage. But it's hard to say, if you don't pay your taxes and I show up at your door and you say, how do you do, neighbor? We're going to shoot you. Even most Americans would say, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. As depressing as most Americans are right now in that regard. Okay, so, like I say, I realize it could have just been a joke, but the point is, if you're going to go that route, it is important to actually be like Ned Flanders, that you don't want to, it's hard to cut the middle ground and say, well, I'm going to be armed to the teeth and have a bunch of illegal weapons and stuff like that, and then I'm also going to try to form this big national tax revolt movement. That those things don't work well together if you're trying to get people on your side and convince them of your cause. Now, if you're doing a different strategy, if you're saying, no, I'm just going off the grid and I'm just going to try to, you know, mind my own business and try to, but I'm going to be armed to the teeth in case push comes to shove, maybe I can get out of that one situation and go to Mexico or something. Okay, that's a different strategy, and maybe your strategy, you can't be like Ned Flanders. Okay, I'm not talking about that. I'm saying this strategy of just trying to get everybody to withhold consent. Okay. Okay, back to totalitarian states, though. So here I've acknowledged, yes, it's theoretically possible we can imagine this knife-edge result where there's one guy at the top of the pyramid and everyone else despises him, wishes he were dead, and the only way he stays in power is that each individual fears that if I disobey him, I'm going to die, and that whole thing is kept sustainable because everyone does actually believe correctly that that's the system. In reality, that's not how it works. If you thought that were the case, that the more totalitarian the society, the more it was based on outright coercion, and the more you would explain its power not by ideology, but by the guns that it has and so forth, you would expect then that the more closed the society is in terms of totalitarianism, that the less you would see propaganda in their educational system and the less control you would see of the media. Because they don't need to control the news. They don't need to control education. If the reason they're keeping everybody in line is at gunpoint, well, then what do you care what people think? Right? It's in the democracies where you would need to fool the public because you've got to trick them into voting for you. But in the tyrannical totalitarian societies, if everyone's in line because they're afraid of getting shot or disappearing in the middle of the night, well, then what do you care what they think? So you see, but that's not the pattern you see. The more totalitarian society, the more they do focus on ideology. The more control they do take over education, the more they censor the internet and make sure that outside news sources don't get in. So it's very consistent with De La Bhatti's view that the way you keep a totalitarian society intact is not, yeah, of course there's the police state and you get rid of dissidents and so on. It is based on fear, but it also, you mold people's thoughts. You convince them that this system is the only one that works and that, oh, you don't want to go to the United States or you don't want to go to South Korea. It's awful there. and you spend a lot of time convincing people of that. And anybody who speaks otherwise, you get rid of that person fast. So, for example, apparently, I saw some guy give a talk at NYU one time on this stuff. In the Soviet Union and North Korea, what they would do, if there was ever any graffiti that challenged the regime, they would clean it up really fast. Whereas if somebody spray paints, you know, Bush is a war criminal or Cheney is a war criminal, that might on a bridge or something, that might stay there for years. It's not like the people in Washington say, oh my gosh, we gotta get rid of that quick. Whereas somebody says Kim Jong-il is a war criminal or is a tyrant over us, we should be free, and put that on a bridge in North Korea, apparently they would clean that up really fast. And why? Because the way that system works is you want people to be isolated. You don't want them to realize that there's hope. You want the people who are thinking, you know, this regime's kind of awful, you don't want them to realize that others are thinking that. You want everyone to just be isolated. Right, so that's consistent with either interpretation. That's consistent with the total fear-based one. But the point is, even there, notice what you're doing is you're molding people's views of the world. Let me tell you a real quick story, and then I got to move on because we're going to run out of time here. I was what the heck is the name of that book? Lessons for the Young Economist. There's a middle section there where I'm talking about the historical experience with socialism. And I got this book on North Korea. This journalist went there, and she was interviewing people who had fled from North Korea. That's what she was doing, and just telling their stories. And it was just shocking, just the primitive hand-to-mouth existence that they had in North Korea, even like in the 1990s, relative to South Korea. So it was really amazing how there could be these people that were fairly close geographically to a decent sort of Western-style country, at least in terms of its standard of living, and yet these people were literally starving to death. So she interviewed this one guy, and she said, "Why did you leave the country?" So this guy fled North Korea, even though he knew that would put his family in danger and stuff like that. So he said his story was interesting. He said, well, it's funny, their propaganda backfired. They said that they showed me a picture of a labor protest in South Korea, and they told me, see, this is why we in North Korea live in a workers' paradise. In South Korea, look how unhappy the workers are. And that's why they're protesting, because capitalism lets the rich, you know, the capitalists exploit the workers, whatever. And he said it backfired because he's looking at this picture, and he was noticing some things about it. And he said, one thing I noticed is that the workers were allowed to protest, and they weren't being shot. And he said, so that was different. You couldn't do that in North Korea. And he said, another thing was he saw in the background all the cars, you know, like behind the labor protest, there was a busy, bustling street with cars. And he said, that was foreign to me, that in North Korea at that point, you know, maybe the party officials would have cars, but the average person got around with a bike or walking or on the back of an animal. And then the other thing he said is he saw that the worker who was like had the megaphone or something was leading the protest. He said he had a ballpoint pen in his pocket, in his shirt pocket. And the guy looking at the photo, the North Korean, said he was blown away at the luxury. He said, imagine that, a worker being able to carry around a ballpoint pen. He just couldn't fathom how wealthy those people must be. Because that was, in North Korea apparently, that was a luxury for the elite, to have a ballpoint pen in your pocket. All right, so that's the kind of thing where the party propagandist who had some connection with the outside world didn't even occur to them that, oh, we can't show them pictures of some of the ballpoint pen, because of course they're all using ballpoint pens and the internet and stuff. They didn't, you know, they forgot the disconnect that they had engineered with their own people. Okay, so that's the point of me telling that, is the only reason North Korea could possibly remain this prison state is that they actually convinced most of their people that this is a decent standard of living. So that when they saw pictures of people with a ballpoint pen, they were like, whoa, those people have pens? I'm getting out of this country. So that's the level of propaganda and miseducation that you need to maintain in order to prop up a dictatorship as brutal as the North Korean one. And it's awful. If you don't know the statistics of that, I mean, just go look at my book, Lessons for the Young Economist, the middle section there. I have some quotes and things about North Korea. It's incredible. Okay, well, I got to move on. Okay, so Rothbard, the essay on desocializing. Let me just run through some of his main topics here and comment on them. So one section is, he says, do not phase in. So what he's getting at here is a lot of these proposals for moving from, so the context is he means literally, if you have a socialist state and you want to turn it into a limited state free market society, what do you do? But we can generalize and say, in general, going from a state to a non-state or to a smaller state with the issue. So he's saying that don't phase it in. That a lot of times liberty advocates, for some reason, want to water down what they're doing and say, oh, we're not going to just do shock therapy. We're not just going to, boom, have freedom overnight. We'll do like a 10-year phase-in or a 5-year phase-in so we don't disrupt things. And Rothbard's saying that's a mistake. That, and he lists a few reasons. So one is, there's no way to efficiently phase it in. That the market works and socialism doesn't work. And if you start liberalizing this sector and then this one 2 years later, and this, it's going to lead to all sorts of bottlenecks and screw things up, which will, first of all, keep socialism in place longer than it otherwise needs to be in place, but also it might discredit the desocialization movement. So he didn't talk about it in this essay, but a good example of this that I use a lot is California, so let's put C for California, electricity deregulation, and I'm putting deregulation in quotation marks. All right, so if you talk to the average leftist, political leftist in the United States, and say, oh, I believe in the free market and utility markets. I don't think the government should have anything to do with electricity. We just had a free market providing electricity to homes and businesses and producing electricity. That would be much better. You wouldn't have blackouts during the summer. It'd be cheaper. Consumers would have more options. People who wanted to buy stuff that was carbon free could pay a premium and it would be cheaper than what they do now, blah, blah, blah. Okay. The average response is probably going to be, oh, we tried that. They tried deregulating electricity markets in California back in whatever year that was. And that's when there was the Enron fiasco and all that stuff, and it didn't work. And there was all kinds of brownouts, and it was just awful. So what are you talking about? You have your theory. Yeah, that capitalism works when it comes to ballpoint pens, perhaps, but it doesn't work when it comes to electricity. And there is a superficial plausibility in what they're saying, that there was something that was called deregulation in the California electricity markets, and even sort of right-wing free market type, or at least in terms of their speeches, politicians got behind it and pushed it, and I would need to go do the research and look it up, but it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of free market pundits endorsed it at the time and said, yeah, this is great. This is freeing up, bringing market price signals and whatever, market forces to the electricity market. This is great. And it clearly screwed up. It didn't work. And it discredited deregulation. So the problem was what they did, I'm simplifying it, but basically they got rid of price controls at the wholesale level, but they kept the price controls at the retail level. And the reason they did that was because they thought there'd be less political backlash, that if you got rid of all the price controls, well, then the local power company can just double the rates they charge homeowners for electricity. And so they get their next bill in the mail, and they're like, what the heck? Last year my electric bill was $200, and this month, last month it was $200, this month it's $400. I'm going to call the mayor. This is an outrage. Right? So they don't want to deal with that. So they kept the price controls regulating what the power providers could charge their final customers, but they got rid of the price control the next level up. So the various producers of electricity that put the electricity into the grid, they, you know, those prices all of a sudden were freed up, so they could charge what the market would bear. And so you had a situation where at certain times of day or for certain areas, the wholesale price was higher than what the utility company was legally allowed to charge its final customer. So what are they going to do? They're just going to shut down, or they're going to, you know, restrict what they're doing instead of losing money for every kilowatt hour they transfer. So if you actually looked at what they were doing on paper to say we're going to lift price controls on the inputs and keep price controls on the outputs, I mean, that's a recipe for a shortage. It would be shocking if they didn't have bottlenecks and brownouts and blackouts after doing that. But yet, that whole thing was touted as privatization or deregulation, I should say, and so it discredited it. All right, so that's one sort of thing. Rothbard also has a great example, a post office example. I don't remember if he says it in this particular essay or if he says it elsewhere, but he said something like, we're talking about deregulating and getting rid of government restrictions and so on. This piecemeal approach can be very dangerous because take the post office. Right? How does the post office work? Right now, it is an entity. It doesn't receive explicit tax funding. What does sometimes happen is if they have a deficit, they get a generous loan from the U.S. government that's more attractive than they can get from the private sector. But really what it is, the post office, its main revenue source is charging its customers. It's not tax money. But it's, of course, its special advantage is it has a monopoly on first-class mail delivery. So you can't just open up a rival postal service and say, I'm going to deliver letters to people and undercut the post office. That's illegal. You can't do that. So that's what they benefit from. Now, to prevent them from just totally abusing people with that monopoly, the government regulates how much they can charge for a stamp. So right now, if the Postmaster General wants to raise stamp prices, he can't just do it. He has to go to Congress and get permission. You know, so he goes there with the books and shows, uh-oh, look, we've been losing money, and we're getting killed because people are emailing and, you know, scanning documents, they're not mailing as much, blah, blah, blah. And so Congress will say, well, why don't you close some offices? Maybe we should stop delivering on Saturday. Okay, and then maybe one of the things they let him do is he raises the price of a first-class stamp. But the point is he can't just charge whatever he wants. So Rothbard was pointing out it would be inaccurate and stupid if a free market economist championing free markets and free price movements had the U.S. government keep the postal services monopoly in place, and then the only thing they tweaked was they said, now the Postmaster General, you don't need our permission to raise prices. You charge whatever you want for a first-class stamp, and we'll be happy with that. But we still will use guys with guns to stop anybody who tries to compete with you. All right, so Robert's saying that would be crazy. There is a sense in which one might call that partial deregulation, right? Yeah, we didn't completely privatize mail delivery, but at least we got rid of the price controls. And now maybe 5 years from now, we'll get rid of the monopoly too. Well, obviously, no, you don't want to do that. That's going to discredit. People are going to be mad when now all of a sudden stamp prices get doubled and you still have the bad service and the long lines and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so you get that. Another example that just occurred to me as I was talking about this is the financial sector right now and what was called the deregulation in the late 90s that some people refer to it as repealing of the Glass-Steagall Act, which it wasn't. But the point is, given that the banks have either explicit backing through FDIC or implicit backing through the Fed and other sundry nods and winks. In that environment, then, you don't want the people running the banks to just be able to do whatever the heck they want. Because then they're going to be way more aggressive. They're going to take on more leverage because they know if it pays off, we get to keep the profits. If it blows up in our face, the taxpayer or the Fed's on the hook. So if you're going to have all of these backstops and guarantees for the banks, you don't want to, at the same time, let them do whatever they want and keep all the profits if they're profitable. So that's another example of this, where so if you're going to start deregulating that, it's going to blow up in your face and discredit the thing if you get rid of the restrictions on what the banks can do, but keep the subsidies and the bailouts structure in place. So if you're going to get rid of it, yeah, get rid of the whole thing. Get rid of FDIC, blah, 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 and then say to the banks, you can do whatever you want. We're not going to regulate you in any way. We shouldn't regulate you. It's a free market. It's a free country, man. But if it blows up in your face and you make a bunch of stupid loans to homeowners who don't even have a job, don't come crying to us when you're insolvent. We're not going to give you a $700 billion equity injection. Okay. Robert says, I got to speed up here. Do not crack down on black markets. That's what they were doing in the Soviet Union. And he's saying, no, black markets are the way people survive under a totalitarian regime or an oppressive regime. The black markets are the way you get around all these crazy regulations. So don't crack down on them. That's the last thing you want to do. So do not confiscate the people's money. That was something they were doing in the Soviet Union too. Do not raise taxes. This is especially applicable to shock therapy as it was practiced in South America and also austerity in Europe right now. This thing. Obviously, I'm speaking here. This Rothbard didn't know what was going to come later. A lot of times what happens is people who are critics of what they call neoliberalism. Critics of neoliberalism, what they'll do is they'll say, oh, I don't believe in free trade. I don't believe in low taxes. I don't believe in balanced budgets. I believe in a strong central government that has industrial planning, has high protective tariffs, currency controls, foreign exchange controls, stuff like that. And you say, well, how can you believe that? Don't you read Standard Economics? Even Paul Krugman isn't for that stuff. And they say, yeah, because look at the World Bank and the IMF. They go around to these countries that are in serious debt and they have massive inflation problems and their people are starving, high unemployment, and they give them these austerity packages and these what Milton Friedman or somebody might call shock therapy, and it didn't work. You know, they're supposed to lower their tariffs and flatten their income tax and privatize government thing, and it's just a bunch of corruption and the people end up broke and the countries more often than not end up poorer than before this alleged reform. And so that proves that free trade doesn't work. So the problem is there's a grain of truth in what they're saying. That these economists from the IMF and the World Bank and the UN and whatever, and then also in these European rescue packages where they come into Greece and Spain or whatever and say, okay, we'll give you guys some loans here to get you through this crisis, but you better reform your system. We don't like all these budget deficits you run. The problem is a lot of times these reform packages involve a large tax increase. And so where these people are coming from is they're saying, oh, you got these huge budget deficits, you need to fix that. So, yeah, they might say cut spending, but they'll also say jack up taxes because you want to balance your budget, and that's the way you get your debt situation under control. But if you've already got a country that's on the brink, if you raise taxes, that might just obliterate them. So I'm just riffing off of Rothbard's point here about do not raise taxes. He was referring to a more narrow thing, but I'm saying generally, like the United Kingdom right now, Paul Krugman's running victory laps saying, I told you guys, they engage in austerity, and now they're in a double-dip recession. I told you, I'm getting so sick of being so right. Well, part of what they did as part of their austerity was they raised the top income tax rate from 40 to 50%. So that's a 25 percentage point, or a 25%, not percentage point, a 25% increase on the upper income earners, and they actually brought in less revenue because a bunch of rich people just left the UK. They were like, I'm not paying that. And they went to a different jurisdiction. Right? So and a lot of free market economists were saying that at the time. What are you doing when you're trying to get out of the worst depression since World War II or since the 30s? You don't raise taxes significantly in your top income earners. That's crazy. But yet Krugman is looking at it in terms of, oh, they were trying to reduce their deficit, and that didn't work, as opposed to raising taxes is a bad idea. Okay. And then he says government firms owning each other is not privatization. He was just saying that Yuri Maltsev had shown him that a lot of what they were doing and announcing as, oh, we're privatizing these former state industries or firms, they were just selling them to other firms in the industry, and it was the same corrupt group of KGB operatives or whoever, Politburo people, that were still the owners in the new regime. And so he was saying they are calling it privatization, but they weren't actually getting it in the hands of the private sector. Okay, so how to desocialize, in the interest of time, I'm not going to dwell on these. It's basically the opposite of the things he said not to do. Let me just stress one point here. At the end, he says privatize or abolish government operations. And so this is an important point that Rothbard makes that a lot of other free market economists don't stress. And he's saying that there are lots of things the government does right now that should not be done. So when we're thinking about how do we go from this system to a voluntary one, don't think that every single thing the government does right now, there needs to be some analog in the private sector doing that. Maybe there doesn't. So obvious things are like tax collection. We don't need to say who would collect taxes in a free society. Nobody would, because there wouldn't be taxes. Stuff like state-run universities, well, there probably would be some analog of colleges and universities in a free society. I think a smaller fraction of the population would be going to them, but there would be some version of that. It's possible that the CIA, yeah, there might be some sort of data intelligence operations in a free society in terms of just staying aware of foreign threats and things like that, but would there be this global network of surveillance where we could send people into other countries and assassinate threats? I don't think so. Okay, so that's what he's getting at there. Okay, let me give you my plantation analogy. So again, this is something I dreamed up. This isn't from Rothbard. In my book that I co-authored, How Privatized Banking Really Works, if you want to go see it in its extended form, we were talking about the premise was, how do you get rid of the Fed? Right, so in the book we had convinced, or we had argued, maybe we didn't convince the reader, we had shown what we thought, the fact that it would be better to have a world with no Federal Reserve where the market produced money, which would probably be gold, instead of having a fiat money central bank institution. So now if we've convinced you that, how would we get to it? And we were talking about the fact that a lot of people right now are dependent on the Federal Reserve system. Just a lot of their expectations, the way the businesses, the banks are all set up with each other. And might one not say somewhat plausibly, we can't just abolish the Fed tomorrow. That if we did that, the whole world would plunge into chaos in the financial system, and that would be awful. And couldn't we have a more gradual unwinding? Not that we're going to drag it out over 50 years, but are we really going to be that hardcore and purist about it and say, no, tomorrow the Fed's abolished? Or isn't there some sort of unwinding that we could do? So rather than answer that question directly, well, we did try to answer it directly, but to sort of bridge the gap between what's the ethical thing and then the pragmatic acknowledgement so that we weren't enshrining injustice, but yet we weren't being completely naive, I came up with this plantation analogy. So I said, all right, imagine you're living back in the day in whatever, 1840, and you have a bunch of siblings, and your dad owns a plantation in the Deep South, and you have 100 slaves picking cotton. And then your dad dies, and he, in his will, gives you and your siblings the plantation and all the slaves. So technically right now, you guys are all the legal owners of these human beings that are living 100 yards away in the slave quarters. And so now you and your brothers and sisters have to figure, maybe it's brothers because maybe the sisters don't have legal recognition or something. You got to, because it's, you know, back in 1840, you got to figure out what are we doing with this? So you're all abolitionists. You've all read the writings of the abolitionists. You think slavery is immoral and that you can't own another human being. So now the question is, what do you do? So one of your brothers says, is real hardcore about it. He's like, we free them all. And we just say, go. And then they leave, and then we, and I don't care what happens to the plantation. If we can't stay in business, then we fold, but we can't perpetuate slavery for a single day. And then somebody else says, oh, but wait a minute, that's a little bit naive. These slaves, through no fault of their own, have grown up in a system of slavery. In a sense, they're kind of dependent upon us to give them their shelter and their food and clothing. They don't even know how to read, a lot of them. What are they going to do? Their whole lives, they have been used to living as slaves. It's very cruel if we just kick them out and say, well, good luck to you. Now you're free. That, you know, who knows what's going to happen to them. But I shudder to think maybe we should keep them as slaves for like a three-year transition process. And then we'll just phase it out. Like we'll identify the ones that seem the most independent, and we'll teach them how to read and blah, 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 and emancipate them. And we'll just kind of do it. We'll have a phased-in freedom. And so that also sounds wrong, right, because why would you perpetuate slavery? You don't want to be slaveholders even for a day. So then what we said is what might be actually pretty reasonable to sort of incorporate both perspectives is to say, okay, we free all the slaves immediately. We go and tell them, you guys are all free. We don't own you. You're not our property. You own yourselves, and you do it legally. You know, you sign the deed over, however you would do it, so that the courts of the day would recognize we're granting them their freedom. It's called manumission. But then you say, we recognize that our dad and his dad and whatever, however long you've been in our family, did bad stuff to you guys, and that you were captured in Africa or whatever and brought over, your grandfather was, and that's awful, and we're so sorry about that, and we feel we owe you a moral debt. So if you want to leave, go ahead. You're free to go. If you are a little bit hesitant to do that because you're not sure how to make your way in the world out there, it's a scary world, you can stay here and you can work for us and we'll pay you wages. We'll hire tutors to come in and teach your kids how to read and and we'll, you know, so we'll do what we can to equip you so you can then go be on your own. But be clear, you are free to leave at any time. So, you know, we're not holding you here against your will. So if you choose to remain here to get rehabilitated, fine. And if you want to stay here forever, you actually like the family and you like our kids because you've raised some of them from birth and, you know, they're your, you almost view them as your nieces or nephews and stuff, that's cool too, and we'll hire you and you'll just be our voluntary worker from now on. And we'll do that. And maybe you'll have a career with us. But the point is you're free immediately. And then, again, we feel this obligation to help you transition. But okay, so that's the thing we were saying in terms of the government. So any bank, and this is what we were saying in the book, any bank that wants to opt out of the Federal Reserve System can do so immediately. If other ones want to stay in the framework and be part of all like the clearing operations and the networks that have already been established over the years, they can still do that, knowing they can be liable. If somebody wants to start issuing currency that's backed up 100% by gold and calling them Rothbards or something, they can do that on day one. But in the meantime, the Treasury, the Bureau of Engraving, and so forth will still print U.S. dollar bills because a lot of people around the world use them, and it might just be a shock if all of a sudden the U.S. says, oh, we don't believe in the dollar anymore, and the U.S. government just says, we're not doing it anymore. That might be unnecessarily disruptive. So we'll still keep printing these things, and we can tie them to gold or blah, blah, blah. But the point is, if you want to compete with that, if some household doesn't want to use dollars, by all means, we're not going to have any sort of legal ramifications on you doing that. But But in the meantime, for those who do want to continue using U.S. dollars, we'll still maintain this apparatus, right? So that was the way we kind of dealt with these thorny issues in that book. Okay, Gandhi's nonviolent resistance. And I emphasized when I typed this slide out the word resistance. A lot of people think about Gandhi and they say, oh yeah, he was about nonviolence. And that's not right. This word that he used to describe his famous salt march and just his approach, I don't know how you pronounce it, Satyagraha, I don't know how to pronounce it. A sort of literal translation would say it was force contained in truth and love, but a more popular rendition is just to call it nonviolent resistance. But again, it's, look at those words, force and resistance. So there's this idea that what Gandhi was preaching, or that if I say, yeah, I'm an anarcho-capitalist in the libertarian sense, and I'm also a pacifist, it's amazing to me how the objections I get from people. They say stuff, oh, so you just think that you should just do whatever the government tells you to do because you're a pacifist. And no. To be a pacifist just means you don't use violence. And maybe get, I might even start using Gandhi's phrase, but maybe this is more, less confusing to people, nonviolent resistance. Right? So that term resistance, he is saying, I actively oppose the government. He's talking about how do I get the government to stop doing, to stop oppressing me and my people. And his philosophy was, both for religious reasons but also for pragmatic reasons, that nonviolence was the way. But it's nonviolent resistance. So the point is, it's not that you're a doormat. It's not that you just roll over and do whatever the government says and hope it'll all work out. Or you say, oh, we'll endure this stuff in this lifetime, but in the afterlife we'll be with God and everything will be great then. That's not what he was telling people. And incidentally, a lot of his, I believe he was inspired by Tolstoy. And the classic example is the kingdom of God is within you. Kingdom of God is within you. So that's a pretty cool, if you've never read that and you're interested in these things, that's a pretty good one to read too. So Tolstoy is coming at it as a Christian, because Tolstoy served in the military. I think he was kind of like a commander or something because he was rich. And he observed how a bunch of Christian pacifists said, no, the way I'm reading the Bible, Jesus doesn't want me using violence against my brothers and sisters. And so like the Russian military apparatus would say, yeah, you're going to go to the front lines, you're going to go kill people, or if not, we're going to throw you in jail. They're going to throw me in jail. Or they'd even threaten to beat them or whatever. And Tolstoy was blown away by the strength, the moral courage of these people, that they would rather get beaten than go harm somebody else. All right, and like I said, they weren't being quiet about it. They were openly saying, no, we're not doing that, and they would explain why. And they were saying it's because that's our religious views. Okay, so whatever you want to say about that, it's not like, oh, I just don't like standing up to people and I'm going to go run in the corner and hide. They were, you know, the way Tolstoy was looking at it, what they did took more courage than just to take the rifle and go to the front lines and shoot to miss, which is what a lot of people did. People who were squeamish about killing somebody would just go to the front lines and go through the motions so they wouldn't get hit in the head by their commander. But and there's actually a lot of stuff about like the front lines in World War I, how awful the opposing sides were at hitting each other. And it wasn't because they weren't trained. It was just because it's hard to get somebody to kill somebody, especially if you don't know the guy. Why would I kill that guy? I have no problem with him. And so that was one of the things that the commanders found was difficult, was how do they get all of these thousands of conscripts who were serving under them to abandon all that they had been taught and to just go out and just murder people who they didn't even know. And that's part of the joys of the modern state, to get people to do that. Okay. Let me extend this to civil rights in the United States. Running low on time here, so I'll be quick. Hang on, let me just look ahead and see what else I want to talk about. Okay, yeah, I got time. Make it real fast. So this is, of course, famously what Martin Luther King taught. Right? So the point was, he was representing a minority group. They were getting oppressed. And he studied Tolstoy, he studied Gandhi, so on. And he concluded that, and also based on his religious views, that both morally and pragmatically, the way he could be effective to get white people to get on his side was not threatening violence, not saying no peace, no justice, no peace. He wasn't being like the Black Panthers or Malcolm X. He was saying, we're gonna shame you into giving us what we want. That white people watching the news and seeing Black people marching and just getting the crap kicked out of them and just taking it would make them go, you know, should we be doing that? What? Whereas if they were armed and they were shooting back and killing a bunch of white cops, then the white people watching would be like, yeah, bunch of thugs, take them out, bunch of criminals. But it's hard to get all moral and upright about, self-righteous about it when you can see guys who are being completely peaceful and are getting the crap kicked out of the people that are on your side. So that was the philosophy. And I saw, and again, this people say, oh, this is like unplanned, or we've got to be strategic. But you, if you do research on this, you'll see this was not some willy-nilly thing. This was a well-thought-out strategy. And I forgot to mention, Gandhi had a 200-mile salt march to protest the salt tax. Okay, so it was a political thing. These guys were strategists. Now, you could say they were wrong, but they were not just saying, oh, we don't want to think about that stuff and we're afraid to make the hard choices. No, they were leaders and they were calculating and thought, given what I have to work with the people who are following me, my influence, what can I do? They decided the best way to achieve my goals to get these governments to do what I want them to do is to call on my followers to do these nonviolent strategies. Right? So in Nashville, they had this thing that I saw a couple of years ago. It was like a museum or something set up talking about the lunch counter sit-ins. This is part of the civil rights movement. So this wasn't Martin Luther King per se. This was a guy earlier than him, and he was teaching all. So it was a lot of Black people, but it was also white people who were sympathetic to their cause, and so they were protesting segregation. And so what they would do is they would go to, you have Black people go to a restaurant that either didn't serve Blacks or said that, you know, Blacks had to sit over here, and they would go and sit where they weren't supposed to. And he would train it. He'd have clinics and train these people. How do you do it? You might say, what do you mean? Don't you just go and sit there? No, because what would happen is people would come up and start punching you and spitting at you and swearing at you and stuff, like white people, and the cops would come because you weren't supposed to be there. You were literally breaking the law in many places, or you were violating what the rules of the establishment were, and a lot of the white people who liked segregation thought you were ending social order, and oh my gosh, we can't have Blacks and whites be on equal footing because that'll be the end of the world. So you had all these angry people coming up to him saying, what are you doing, and swearing at him and punching him in the face and stuff and spitting at him, whatever. So part of these training sessions was to tell you, how do you deal with that? Because you can't hit back. That was the whole point, and not just because of moral reasons, but because what we're going to do is we're going to show the world that we're right and these bigots are wrong. So we're going to sit there and have these bigots come up. We want them to punch us. We want to get that on tape. And we're going to sit there and just get the crap kicked out of us, have people spit on us. So then the rest of the world is going to realize, oh my gosh, look at these monsters mistreating these poor victims. And so what they would do is, you know, the part of these clinics was to inculcate why this was important and we have to all be together on this, but also how do you minimize the damage to any one of us? So part of what he was teaching was how, you know, like if you're on the inside, like so there's a group of 10 of you that go into this diner and you're sitting at the lunch counter and the people who come up to you and start punching you are on the outside. So the people getting whacked are, you know, in the outer ring. And so he was saying, you got to like watch and see, okay, have you had enough? And then you let them get on the inside, and then you go on the outside, and you get punched until you can't take it anymore. And then so that was like the kind of thing they were getting trained how to do. And they were getting trained on as people are asking, this wasn't Martin Luther King. I can't remember the guy's name. I can try to find it and send you guys an email. What I'm talking, I mean, Martin Luther King was friends with this guy, and he was inspired by it, but this was different. So anyway, the point is just that was their strategy. So again, you can say this is crazy or that that's unnecessarily, you know, why do we need to take such damage? We can do something else. But the point is, it was not just, oh man, I don't want to think about these big things. It was a well thought out campaign, and that was a conscious objective from these leaders of this movement to get rid of these segregation laws. All right, and like I say, it was, and they also would equip people to say, like, what do you say when someone comes up and says, hey, what you're doing is a crime. The people, you know, they didn't just swear back at them or something. Like, they would be taught, this is what you say. If some white guy comes up to you and says, you're breaking the law, then, you know, maybe you quote scripture back at them. Like, if you're in the Bible Belt or something, and say, well, didn't, you know, St. Paul break the law when such and such? Or, you get what I'm saying? I'm making that up. I don't know what they said. But the point is, these people would be trained as to how do we conduct ourselves, because they realize these revolutionary leaders realize, you know, it would be tremendously powerful if I had 10,000 people that would all do X. That would be very potent, where X did not involve shooting anybody or swinging back or swearing. Okay, I'm a little bit over time. Libertarian Nuremberg trials. I just Googled for Dick Cheney and got this hilarious picture because it kind of looks like he's getting strung up. Walter Block talks about this a lot and is giving you different perspectives about this. How do we get there? So if you Google Walter Block and this phrase, Libertarian Nuremberg trials, you'll see his perspective. So he's thinking, you know, he goes through, like, in terms of standard libertarian punishment theory, like, the guy who delivers first-class mail for the post office, technically his job is due to this legal monopoly they have, but clearly he's not as guilty as Dick Cheney is, if you believe that the U.S. government is this evil entity that's systematically oppressing people. And so Block goes through and, you know, how would we assign blame the way after World War II has ended, people went and looked at the members of the Nazi regime and assigned culpability. So that's what he does there, so some of you might be interested in that. Okay, then the last thing, and I'll wrap it up here, is so what's my big picture thing? Well, obviously you guys can tell from the tenor of my remarks, I think, not because libertarian theory requires it, but just as a matter of pragmatic, you know, we're in the minority, how do you convince a majority of people to look at what you're doing, that violence can be very counterproductive because it scares people and it makes them suspicious of you, whereas it's very effective if you can do it, that if you're completely in the right in terms of being very civil and humble and just people are being unnecessarily rough with you, that garners sympathy for people. Like on Facebook, the photo of that lady who's handcuffed and the cop, and she's on the ground and a cop is kicking her in the face. When I want to convince people that the police are brutal in the United States, I'll use that photo. Whereas Waco isn't as effective because they did have guns and stuff in there. And they, you know what I mean? It's not that the people in the compound at Waco deserve what happened to them, but I'm just saying it's people can make excuses for the government if they want to, where it's kind of hard to defend the cop when the lady's handcuffed on the ground getting kicked in the face. Right? That's the kind of thing I mean. But whatever your views are, let me just make this final point, that education is clearly necessary, and some might argue it's sufficient, that right now, whatever your strategy, whether you think it's going to take a bunch of guns, and also for any law enforcement officers watching this, I personally, of course, am not recommending anyone break any laws. So, my teeth shine. But I'm saying whatever your views are as to what the best way is to achieve this thing, this state of society that you prefer, you clearly need more people thinking like you, whatever your strategy, unless you happen to be from Krypton. All right? So if you think it's going to take a violent revolution 30 years from now, well, you need more people on your side of the battle lines. And so you've got to be handing out Rothbard's books. so that they can see why would you want to fight for this. If you think it's going to take people going off the grid and eventually it's more and more, you need more people doing that for it to work, for it to matter. And so you need to be passing out pamphlets, teaching people about how free markets work, why gold is better than fiat money, that kind of stuff. Or if you're more like me and just you daydream about a society where one day everyone just says, nope, we're not paying attention to you guys anymore, and the government is, but we're the government. And they say, well, how would you get there? Again, you have to convince people. So clearly, whatever you're thinking, education is a necessary route. We need to convince more people of the vision of an anarcho-capitalist society. And I would argue it's sufficient that when you get to the point where you have enough that you could win a violent revolution, you don't need to fight it. Or just do whatever you did to get to that point and do it 10% more. You get what I'm saying? So all the people that would be fighting on the government side, just get more and more of them to go to your side. If the truth is on your side, if your ideas are correct, you can convince more and more of them. And then, you know, if that's working, if you get to the point where you realize, oh, we could really take down the government if we really, you know, if we were willing to lose 200,000 of our people, but we'd free ourselves, well, don't kill, there's no reason for 200,000 people to die. Just keep doing whatever you did to get to that level, and convince another million people who would fight for the government to come on your side, as my final thoughts from Bob Murphy. Okay, and again, like I say, anyone from the CIA or FBI watching this, I do not in any way condone violent insurrection or law-breaking of any kind. Okay, well, over time, thanks everyone for the course. I will, as always, try to catch up on your any questions that are pending from this. There will be an office hours this week, and I'll just send you an email for that, and then I'll be on the forums too. And there's a quiz that will open up Friday, and then there will also be a final, and I'll send out an email blast for all that. All right, thanks everybody.